Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. This year's distinguished public historian at MTSU is Dr. Spencer Crewe. He'll be leading a panel discussion at 7 o'clock on May 29th in the main courtroom on the second floor of the Rutherford County Courthouse. The topic is American slavery and its impact on universities past and present. Dr. Crewe graduated with a Ph.D. in history from Rutgers University. He worked with the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History, working his way up from historian to executive director of the NMAH. And also in 2001, he became executive director CEO of the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center in Cincinnati, resigning in 2008 to take a faculty position at George Mason University. Welcome to Murfreesboro and to MTSU, Dr. Crewe.
Well, thank you. I'm excited to be here. It's been a good experience so far.
And you're teaching a class this semester? Let's talk about that up front before we get to the panel discussion. What class are you teaching?
Well, I'm teaching a class with the title is essentially Issues of Conscience, Commemoration, and Memory in Museums and Historic Places. What we're interested in looking at is how museums and historic places in the 21st century begin to find ways to be much more engaged with the community and have much more of an impact in terms of the programs that they do. And in particular, interested in the ideas of how they can become places that encourage civic engagement and social responsibility. So we're looking at a variety of different places, reading some of the writings that have gone on in that area, and then talking about how that is applied and how these students who are going to be public historians can think about it as their own careers go forward.
Something I've noticed about museums lately is that they've become more interactive. Is that part of the process? Having things in the museum that kids and grown-ups alike can reach out and touch, feel, punch, turn on, turn off.
Well, certainly interactivity is an important part of this process of how museums are evolving. And we want to find ways in which we can get younger visitors engaged and to see the visit to a museum as something they look forward to that's enjoyable rather than a chore and a painful thing to do. But in addition, what we're interested in is beyond interactivity on a sort of tactile basis, really thinking about how museums and historic places can encourage people to think about the role they have in society and how they can be citizens in society and help to make that world a little bit better through the various choices and decisions they make in the course of their lives.
On to the topic of the panel discussion now, and there might be some crossover we can explore later, but first of all, let's go back to the subject of American slavery and its impact on universities past and present. I understand that there are some universities that have taken a proactive role in examining their own ties to slavery. University of Maryland is one. Brown University is one. How would you gauge the success or lack of success that these institutions have achieved in this area?
I think success is a tough word to use because you're not sure how you measure success. I think that it's a step in the right direction, that these institutions have decided to proactively begin to examine what role their founders, what role their trustees, what role the institution itself had in connection to the institution of slavery in this country, and to begin to think about its meaning and how it influenced their development and how it influenced their philosophies. And I think just that step forward is an important one, especially for institutions of higher learning, because part of it is the exploration, the learning, but also the conversations and the discussions that evolve from it as you really begin to think about that role. I followed much more closely the discussion at Brown University, which is my undergraduate school. And I think that what they have done has been very interesting, getting out ahead of the curve in terms of discussing it, but not approaching it with any kind of particular specific goal in mind, but rather how do we as a institution of knowledge increase our knowledge around these issues and then think about what are the repercussions of it and how might we think about responding to that in the present day.
Has this been an ongoing process at institutions of higher learning examining their connection to slavery that they've been doing all along, or is it a relatively recent epiphany that they've had?
I think it's been a much more recent experience for a lot of institutions. It has a lot to do with the efforts of individuals who are thinking about the question of reparations and whether or not as a nation there is a need for reparations to the ancestors of enslaved people who did so much to help the economic growth of this nation but weren't paid or compensated for their efforts. And I think those pressures, those discussions, and those insistences by those individuals interested in reparations have caused a lot of institutions, both educational, business, and a variety of others, to stop for a minute and think, let's look at our history, let's see what connections we have to it, and are there things, are there choices we can make that can help us at least acknowledge it? Or maybe in some ways find the steps we can take to, you can't atone for it, but possibly at least begin to indicate a sense of responsibility for that involvement in a much earlier time.
In reading a little bit before I came here about the subject, it never occurred to me, although it makes perfect sense that this would occur given the nature of the time, that some students, white students, took their slaves to school with them when they went to college. And that, how did the slave integrate himself into that level of university life in his continuing subservient role?
Well, I think certainly those who were enslaved didn't go to class and weren't taught as the other students were. I think.
But how did he have to be equally deferential to all of his master's buddies and so forth?
Well, I think if you're an enslaved person during that period, you are careful how you interact with anyone who is white. And so I think they do have to figure out what is the right way to act, which they're a white way to react, and just how does one find the right survival mechanisms within those circumstances. And it can vary, because there are students who took their enslaved people with them to Southern schools, to schools in Philadelphia, and to some Northern schools. So I think, again, it depends upon where that person's going, what the environment is like there, and what the expectations are on that campus.
Did being in a university climate give a slave who was hungry for knowledge but who in other circumstances might have been beaten if he tried to learn how to read or something of that nature, did it give him an opportunity to try to learn things on the sly because he had quasi-access to an institution? He was physically there.
Yeah, I think it does offer that opportunity, but again, I'm always cautious about being too broad in that, because it depends, one, on whether or not that individual accompanied the person to class and therefore was in the class, or were they outside the window where they could hear, or were they back in the dorm sort of doing all the variety of kind of things they need to do to take care of the master's or the slaveholder's clothing or food and those kind of things. But I think it certainly puts them in a different atmosphere than they would be if they were on a plantation or on a farm where they are a laborer in the fields on a regular basis. So we would think the opportunities would be there. It's just a matter of whether or not you have that access that you'd like to have.
Would the majority of them, these students who had slaves, would they be relatively benign masters who wouldn't mind if their slave took a peek at their biology book, or would they be more likely to come down hard on them?
I'm careful about trying to be too broad.
Right.
But I think that it sort of depends upon what kind of master they were back in the previous situation. If they were an individual who was more relaxed about the rules, my guess would be that as their child went off, or as that person went off, they would continue to be more relaxed about the rules. If they were someone who was very strict and brought this individual along strictly to care for them, then I think they probably would not allow that kind of access and might even be on guard to ensure that it wouldn't happen. I mean, I'm aware of cases where individuals went north with a slaveholder. It was sort of detected that they were beginning to acquire some education, and they were sent back. Other times, individuals were supposed to go, and then it occurred to the slaveholder that, in fact, this might be a chance for an education. They decided not to send them. So you can see the variation across the board with this. I think most often the expectation was that they did not want or encourage those enslaved individuals to get more education, because that's the kind of thing that could be detrimental to that person's acceptance or ease and being enslaved.
It's not that many steps removed from that kind of experience, is it, to after the Civil War, especially in the Southern universities, for having African Americans now freed in the continuing subservient role of kitchen servers mm-hmm. and janitors mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's still the same kind of climate minus some of the violence. For all intents and purposes, okay. It's still that subservient way of, well, this is the only way black people can help the university function.
Well, I think that after the Civil War, you're correct that the effort is to try to maintain enslavement in a different form mm-hmm. and to find ways to keep African Americans at the bottom of the economic ladder. So you're right, Southern universities didn't open up their doors mm-hmm. and encourage the freedmen to gain, to come in and take advantage of the education there. Instead, you begin to have a number of black institutions come into existence in the 10 or 20 years after Reconstruction. You have a whole group of historically black colleges that come into existence, places like Fisk, Tuskegee, and places like that that began to be places of higher learning for African Americans.
Because they had no place else to go, they had to do it themselves,
yes.
essentially.
Yes, yes. If you wanted a higher education, unless you went to some northern universities.
I believe there were maybe one or two African American HBCUs that started before the Civil War, but not very many.
No, none start before the Civil War.
None
at all?
They
are all after the Civil War.
Okay.
I think most HBCUs get their start in the early 80s, late 70s. But it's clearly after the Civil War and into Reconstruction.
Okay. Not even up north, huh?
I'm not aware of any that get started that early. There are schools that admit African-American students. Oberlin College is well known for having done that. So that's an early one. But
So a small liberal arts college in Ohio.
Yes, yeah, in northern Ohio. I think most HBCUs get their start, even in the north, after the Civil War.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it true that some universities actually owned slaves themselves, the institution owning the slave?
Yes, I think one of our speakers, Alfred Brophy, has found that to be the case. I can't remember which of the universities it was. It may have been the University of Alabama. But they came across an instance where there were slaves who were at the university on a regular basis. And what he was trying to determine is if the president owned the slaves, if the faculty owned slaves, or if the university owned slaves. And I think he did run across an instance where it turned out so was the university mm-hmm. who was the owner.
That would be interesting to me to find out whether or not there were, as there were on the plantations, house slaves and field slaves, especially if it was an agricultural college like Auburn. Do you have slaves working in the fields and slaves working in the president's office?
So the instinct is to think that's possibly the case.
Yeah.
I'm not the expert. That's why I'm bringing in these two gentlemen, Dr. Alfred Brophy and Dr. James T. Campbell, who've done much more research in that area. But in having talked to them and gone to sessions with them, mm-hmm. I get the sense that you're description of the circumstances of some individuals is correct.
It would seem counterintuitive that they would not, especially in a southern institution, adapt the plantation model to the institution of higher learning.
Yeah, I think your instincts are probably right.
Okay. What about the curriculum, especially in the southern institutions? Did people like John C. Calhoun come off as gods in the history classes? Were the history classes also incomplete as K through 12 they were for many, many years with regard to African Americans of note who had made a great impact on this country's history?
Yes. I sort of have a better awareness of what was going on in Virginia. And what I'm pretty clear about in Virginia is that there was a Virginia version of the Civil War history of the South, which was very complimentary of Robert E. Lee and others like that, and that the accomplishments of African Americans were either ignored or very much in the mode of a birth of a nation, that there was this terrible period after the Civil War in which African Americans were able to get into office and they just did terrible things, and it was important to remove them from office, to push them back to the bottom of the social and economic scale, and to redeem the government back to closer to the way that it was before those days.
I think I'd also be interested to know from a pedagogical standpoint, if I were at the panel discussion mm-hmm. on May 29th at the Rutherford County Courthouse, that whether in the science classes, they taught a sort of eugenics approach, biological inferiority on the basis of race.
Yes, but that's not just in the South. That's a nationwide movement in which there is a push to create a scientific basis for talking about the inferiority of African Americans, but also of some other groups in the nation who they were worried might be coming as immigrants and might be undermining the growth and development of the United States. So eugenics became a way of rationalizing, excluding people or treating them differently from others.
And if you've got that as a background, if you've got that going into the minds of the students that you're sending out into the world, it's tantamount to, or it's just another form of institutional perpetuation of racism.
Oh, I think absolutely. And I think that's part of the reason for these studies, to think about the role of slavery and race early on in these institutions, because if it's in fact very much a part of the fabric of the institution and the philosophies and the ideas that they push forward, you are continuing a way of thinking that's not going to make it very easy for the generations that follow of the ancestors of these individuals to have success. They have a number of mountains they have to climb before they're even seen to be on anywhere near an equal basis.
If the impact of slavery on universities is important, the flip side of slavery being the abolitionist movement, what impact, if any, did it have on institutions of higher learning?
Well, I think it certainly in the North helped to influence how people thought about the institution of slavery. Whether or not they thought it was appropriate, given our positioning as a nation that believes in liberty and equality and in freedom. And so I think it does call into question whether or not we are living up to the ideals that we've set forth as a nation in terms of a different kind of operation in a place where people have opportunity to have success.
How important were slaves to maintaining the economic existence of institutions of higher learning in those times? Could the institutions have existed with the cost that they had to incur in order to be, in order to educate their students without unpaid labor to keep the floors clean, to cook the meals, to do whatever was necessary?
Well, I think about it in even more of a basic way, and that is that most of these institutions depended upon either state money to exist, or they depended upon the donations of wealthy individuals to keep them going, even more so than just the cooking of meals and the cleaning of floors. And those individuals and those state monies, especially in the South, were dependent upon the institution of slavery. And if that's the case, then it comes directly from the labor and the work of those individuals who are enslaved, planting the crops, caring for them, harvesting them, and getting them off to market for a profit for those who own those plantations. So I think that much more directly indicates the importance of slavery and those individuals in terms of the existence and economic survival of these institutions.
Were Northern institutions any different? Institutions where there were in non-slave states, did they take any kind of a different attitude either in how they treated African Americans on their campus in labor relationships, or in terms of what they taught in the classroom about African Americans?
I think essentially up to the Civil War and thereafter for a while, probably not in most places, that issues of race, issues of discrimination and segregation existed in all parts of the country. The study that was done at Brown University that Dr. James Campbell will be talking about illustrates that in the fact that in Rhode Island, which you rarely think about in terms of its connection to slavery, actually was an important state for importing slaves from Africa. And that a big part of its economy was from the ships that were sent to Africa to bring them back for sale so they could then take that money and invest it into their manufacturing. So that a lot of universities and institutions find themselves complicit in ways they didn't expect. And I think the issue, again, of race and of discrimination and equality are often to the detriment of African Americans, not seeing them as positive parts of the community.
In either the slave states or the non-slave states, did any institutions attempt to take a more enlightened approach? And if they did, was there a backlash from donors, the community, anything of that nature? Or were they too scared to attempt to venture into that area altogether?
Well, I think there are universities that go in that direction. We talked about Oberlin.
Yeah.
And in the community in which they existed, I think there was much less difficulty because very early on they were a university that was active in abolitionist activities, active in taking steps in opposition to slavery. And the town in which they lived is also an important stop on the Underground Railroad. So you have a community there that is much more open and supportive to the ideas of pushing back against slavery and of encouraging African Americans to come to the town and to use it as a stop on their way to freedom. But there are other places in the North, not just universities, but even at the high school level, where any attempt to encourage African Americans to come to those schools is met with great resistance. So there's a wonderful story in the state of Connecticut where there's a woman by the name of Prudence Crandall, who has the audacity to decide to allow black girls to attend classes at her all-girls school. Well, the parents there are very angry about that and pull all of their daughters out. And Prudence then decides that she says, fine, then I'm going to run an all-black girls school. And that still angers the local residents, and they take away her credit. They begin to attack her and finally take her to court to stop her from doing that. And eventually she's forced to close down her school. So I think it gives you a sense of the depth of resistance that people have to educating black students, even in a segregated setting, as far north as some place like Connecticut.
How did slavery shape the historic debate between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, both men who were both very much concerned with education, but with two totally different perspectives on how the African American could progress?
I think it's the legacy of slavery and how one responds to it that is at the core of the disagreement between the two individuals. And I think it also has to do with where they live in the United States, that Booker T. Washington is in the South. He is at Tuskegee. The story goes that within the first month or so that he was there, there was a lynching somewhere in that area. So he's very much aware of the fact that the atmosphere there and the environment there is very tenuous for African Americans. So his approach to it is not to try to break down the walls, but to begin to find ways in which African Americans can progress, but which will not direct violence towards them, will not direct as much anger towards them. And his argument is that you need to learn a trade. You need to learn how to work with your hands. You need to begin to take on roles that allow you to progress economically, but won't be seen as a major threat in the eyes of the people in the community where you live. Du Bois is in the North, and Du Bois sees things entirely differently. He believes that labor is a good thing, but that you also have to encourage people to get a liberal education, to question society, to combat the issues that they're confronted by directly, and as he says, to agitate. And so he sees Washington as not being strong enough, and Washington probably sees him as not being realistic enough. And I think if you look at the core of their disagreements, that's a lot that has to do with it.
How did slavery serve as a touchstone for the students of the 1950s and 1960s in changing the face of the civil rights movement and demonstrations on campus with regard to this subject? Mm-hmm. In David Halberstam's book, The Children, he talks about Diane Lane and the students at Fisk who were essential in Nashville's attempts to achieve a more integrated, inclusive society.
Yeah. Well, I think it is very much a case of the rise of what's called African American history and a growing sense of the contributions of African Americans, which is a counter to the long-standing picture of African Americans as enslaved individuals who were content with their situation and really just went along with things. And I think what the students were learning is that, in fact, that the enslaved people were not content. They were not happy in their circumstance, and that they were pushing back and trying to create change. And if nothing else, that begins to give you a different sense of your own history, your own place in the society, and a sense of empowerment and encouragement to continue to push to change to make things different. So I think if slavery has a role in that thinking, it's probably in that way.
You have probably encountered before, and I'll lay you odds you encounter somebody who says this at the panel discussion. It happened so long ago, and we've come so far. Why go back all that way?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it goes back to a statement you made about the legacy of slavery and the legacy of how we see race. And if, in fact, that continues to be an important part of our society, first of all, we have to understand its source, and we have to understand how it became so much a part of how we operate as a society, to also understand that it's not gone away, that it is still a part of our lives, it's still a part of how people navigate the world, and you need to recognize that. And I think by talking about this, by examining it, by understanding it, it allows us to have a context for the world in which we live. But it also allows people to understand how other people see the world, also understand how other people experience their lives, because I think it's hard for all of us to understand exactly or clearly the kind of experiences that others have. And unless you have a chance to engage, have a conversation, to understand, to internalize that, you continue to live in different kinds of worlds and make assumptions that don't have a validity, in fact, a validity in real information. And I think these conversations are important in terms of beginning to broaden that sense of understanding for a variety of people in the society so they can begin to think about, if this is the case and if these things are going on, what can we do to make things better? Certainly they are better than they were, but no one would suggest that we are in nirvana and that life is perfect in any way at all. So the key is to keep striving and to keep moving to try to reach that ultimate goal of the kind of society where everyone does feel that their chances for opportunity, their chances for success are available. And I think that's not the case in today's world.
Does the irony of the fact that colleges and universities tolerated slavery, had slaves, endorsed slavery, endorsed the diminution of the African American. Does the irony of that still hit you in the face, or as an academic and historian who's been drenched in this for so long, are you just more or less inured to it? I mean, the most intelligent, most sophisticated, most supposedly progressive people of the society, the educated elites, and they're still back in the back on this topic.
Well, I guess what strikes me is that universities are a reflection of the societies of which they are a part. And I think what these studies remind us is that that was the case then as well, and that education doesn't necessarily mean enlightenment. It may mean knowledge, but it may not mean knowledge in the fullest sense of the word. So I think that rather than being surprised, it sort of reinforces my sense of as a historian that societies change and grow, but they also have sort of a circularity to them. And that what we're seeing here is that the people who ran these universities, who were in charge, some did not buy into the thinking of the time, but others did. And I think for us today, it's an important lesson as well to really examine what we're thinking, to examine the assumptions that we make, and to decide whether or not we need to think differently or look more deeply at some of the issues that exist for us in the world today, and do we need to make steps to make them different, to make them better?
The panel discussion is titled American Slavery and Its Impact on Universities Past and Present. It'll start at 7 p.m. May 29th in the main courtroom on the second floor of the Rutherford County Courthouse. Dr. Spencer Crewe, thank you for being with us here today.
Thank you very much. I enjoy talking to you.
Same here. This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at this same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can always check out the podcast at your leisure at www.mtsunews.com, and we're also available on iTunes.